The Lima Coast to Coast, Show 42, June 27th, 2007. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. There are numerous ways to contact the podcast. The first is via email, podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com, through the website at www.thelemacoasttocoast.com, via voicemail at 206-600-5782, via mail at Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, 30065, and that's in the U.S. And via MySpace at www.myspace.com/ThelemaCoastToCoast. There are some other ways, but those will do for now. Those who are on the Thelema Coast to Coast website, that's going to be changing in about a week. My hosting with the current provider is going to be expiring, and I'm going to be moving it, so expect to see that change shortly. But I think it will also give people a chance to give immediate feedback about individual episodes versus going into the forum discussion and talking about episodes. I want to see how that will work out, so people will feel free to participate. The next thing is listener feedback. I'm getting into that immediately because I have a lot of feedback to go through. So the first is an email from Luke in Australia. He says, "Hello, John. First of all, commendations for the quality of your program. I stumbled across your podcast a few weeks ago at a time when I was doing some internet research on Thelema and reading the Book of the Law for the first time. I'm still in the process of catching up on the latest episode, but I found the podcast to be very informative, insightful, and educational, not to mention entertaining. As a newcomer to Thelema, and hence someone who is in the early stages of studying it and figuring out what it means to me, and if it's something I want to pursue further, I thought you might be interested in my viewpoint of Thelema and Thelemites, especially in reaction to such feedback as you received in podcast number 31 about Thelemites acting up at OTO activities and making a nuisance of themselves. Your response to the email really struck a tone in me, as it mirrored my own growing suspicions about the attitude of many self-confessed Thelemites that I hear about through your program. To me, until you discover your will, you cannot know what it is, and you cannot possibly be behaving in accordance with it, and you should be embarrassed to claim to your fellow Thelemites that you are living your true will when behaving stupidly. It seems there are many people who call themselves Thelemites who interpret Thelema as, quote, indulge every whim, close quote, or, quote, act like an idiot, close quote, instead of do what thou wilt. Yourself and Keith418 have talked about this many times. What I find astonishing is that even I, as a complete newcomer to Thelema, can see that these people are misguided and don't understand Thelema at all, and I don't seem... and don't seem to be interested in studying it as a philosophy, and they are OTO members. Surely they should be much more knowledgeable on the subject than I, or have I really missed the point of Thelema? I hope this doesn't offend the serious Thelemites out there like yourself and Keith418, but they are making the OTO look bad, and they should leave the organization and form their own, quote, social misfits who want to be free of responsibility, close quote, order, instead of muddying the waters of the OTO. Till I began listening to your show, I assumed the OTO and the AA were very serious and dignified groups of people working as hard at the esoteric path as Crowley did himself. I know there are serious students out there, both within the OTO and without, and they may indeed vastly outnumber the idiots. But like I said, these individuals are making the order look bad. Thanks for reading this, and keep up the great work. Excuse the apparent ignorance of leaving out the 93 greeting, but I figured I'd be a real sheep to suddenly adopt it when I can't even call myself a Thelemite yet. Luke. Well, Luke, thank you very much. Luke did send a secondary email where he says, let's see, this is my second email to you, so I'll skip the superlatives about your show. They still stand. I'll try to be more specific, though. My favorite segments are the Keith 418 interviews. If only every Thelemite and every OTO member were serious about Thelema Crowley and the OTO in the same way that you guys are, it sounds very disappointing. Please continue the discussions, and I'm sorry to hear via another podcast that you got kicked out of the OTOs for your outspokenness. I wish I could give some constructive criticism, but I really do like all your interviews. The only issue I have with the show is the music. I suppose, with the exception of Lon Milo's songs you've played, it's rarely to my taste, but no music will ever please anyone. At least I can always skip to the next episode. Luke. Well, thanks, Luke. Thanks for the two emails. Well, what can I say? Yeah, there are a lot of irresponsible and foolish people in the Order and outside and who make Thelema look bad. But, that's not that uncommon. I mean, how many Christians do you know who make Christianity look bad? So we do what we can, and I would encourage you, if you're interested in Thelema, to really engage in the works of Aleister Crowley and some of the his contemporary writers or his students, and really get a good idea of what Thelema is about from them. A lot of the modern authors really don't know what the hell they're talking about and should be just ignored. Anyway, let's go on to the next one. This one is from Adrian. I think he's written before. He says, 93, John, I've literally just finished listening to Thelema Coast to Coast 41 and would just like to say thank you so much for a wonderfully well-presented and informative show. To me, it seems to represent a definitive stage of the podcast's evolution, ushering in a new level of maturation, which is very much to your credit. Despite my previous mail, I have to say that your latest discussion with Keith 418 was reasoned, calm, and raised some very important issues which precious few people are either able or willing to address. Listening to you talking reminded me so much of the conversations I myself had with occultist friends whose opinions I respect. I'm not saying I personally agree with all the issues raised, but I don't have to. That's the point. Once again, John, thanks for all the work you've put into the podcast over the last 2 years. As always, I look forward to seeing what you do next as life starts a new phase for you. I wish you all the best. Hopefully we can meet in person at some point, Adrian. Well, thank you. It's good that you don't agree all the time. We're not looking for agreement. We're looking for people to engage and think. So if you don't agree, that's fine. The next email is from Giles. He says, hi, John. I'm listening to your interview with Frater WIT, and for those who don't know what that is an interview I had on the last podcast talking about his book, Enochian Initiation. Frater WIT mentions Regardi Ceremonial Magic being out of print. It has been reprinted a year or two, as has his Foundations of Practical Magic by Eon Books. Ceremonial Magic is still available on Amazon.co.uk. They both should be obtainable via the Aeon Books website, www.aeonbooks.co.uk. That it has been republished might not be widely known, so this may help change this. Regards, Giles. Well, thank you for the announcement, and anybody who's interested in getting those two works from Regardi can go directly to aeonbooks.co.uk. And yes, you can get them from Amazon, and that may be convenient. However, you know, I encourage everybody when they can to go to the publisher's website and order it direct. The publishers end up getting the same amount of money. This is assuming there's not some enormous discount. It's hard being in publishing, and the publishers don't make a lot of money. And sure, you may not save that 5 or 10%, which will cost you another few bucks. But for them, that kind of money starts to add up after a while. So I really encourage people to go to the publisher website and purchase directly from the publisher if they can, especially on very small presses. Every little bit helps them. All right. The next email is from Willis. He writes, 93 John, longtime listener, first time responder. Haven't gotten many of that kind of opening. So, first would like to congratulate you on your episode 39. It was some of your best work. I especially enjoyed the discussion on Freud's totem and taboos. I had read the material before, but had always focused on the killing and consuming the primal father effects upon the ideas of Christianity. Keith's 4:18's focus on the primal father himself was something I had missed and allowed me to go back and reread the material with a different perspective. Next, as a longtime member of the Golden Dawn and a new Thelemite, I am completely perplexed by the lack of publishing Crowley books by the OTO, as you touched on in episode number 40. You do not see this in the Golden Dawn community. Rigardi's books are constantly getting reprinted, often with new material. Pat Zalewski's Where Raw Material is easy to acquire. Even the more obscure items, like the Golden Dawn Journal series, is coming back into print after a short drought. Why not Crowley? In the podcast, you touched on a number of possible reasons, including non-interest of buyers, lack of money, a bad relationship with the publishers, among others. But none of this touches the heart of the matter. The books are not coming out because it is not a priority to the OTO. If it was a priority, then it would be accomplished regardless of the obstacles. Why it is not a priority is one discussion. What is their priority instead is what interests me. The OTO has a priority either consciously or not. What is it? The recent crackdown on blog posting, etc., is not their priority, but a symptom of their true aims, whatever those might be. Perhaps you and Keith could discuss this in a future podcast. Regardless, keep up the good work, and I look forward to listening to more shows. Yours in the great work, Willis. Well, Willis, I think one of the main priorities of the OTO is to make a fun social environment. I see a lot of the activity with the OTO members and bodies less about magic, less about Thelema, less about engaging in the material, and more about having social engagements, having parties, throwing festivals. The biggest event in the OTO is not a large magical ritual, is not, anything related to Crowley, really. The biggest thing is their Noticon, which happens every 2 years, an OTO convention, in which the OTO members get together and basically spend a whole weekend partying. You know, there is a pretext of having conference lectures about things, but I think most people will admit that the lectures are tertiary, to say the least. So it really is about a social who's who and being seen and hooking up and doing drugs and partying. And, a lot of the local bodies are the same way, too. And it's really disappointing that so much of the OTO members and organization as a whole is moving away from the material. And that's why we see the priority is not on republishing Crowley. If you're interested in having a good time and hanging out with your friends, reading a book of Crowley's journals or reading a book of Crowley letters like Magic Without Tears is just not a priority. I mean, that's something you do by yourself. It's not something that you can go and have a good time or get fucked up to do. So it ends up, you know, being something that gets put on the shelf and eventually forgotten. So it seems to me, after being in the OTO since 1992, that it's just really not a priority. They're more interested in having social engagement. And that's a lot of why you see the OTO attracting the lowest common denominator of the society. And all of those who are, responsible or interested in the material end up leaving the order at one time or another because it really can't engage them. And they get tired of wasting their time with people who can't even show up at a meeting not fucked up on drugs. So anyway, that's kind of a little bit of it, Willis. Thanks for emailing. All right, the next email is from Mark. He writes, "Hello, Mr. Crow. Prompted by your Thelemic email, I contacted Behutik and wound up writing an article for them, which should be in the next issue. Thanks for letting me know about the easing, Mark." Well, good. I'm glad. Bahuta is a is very unique. I wish there were more people out doing things like Bahuta, but unfortunately, they're kind of like the books. There's not a big push for it. Also, you know, the quality of articles vary in Bahuta. So I wish more people who were engaged in the work would choose to write for it. But we'll see how that goes. The next email is from a listener who writes anonymously. He writes, "Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Hi, John. I'm a young Thelemite, part of a new generation, perhaps? A 20-something kid who is finally free of his parents and societal influence, free to do his will and practice as Thelemic a lifestyle as possible. I listened with great interest to your episode 40, and I just got to tell you, it ticked me off. You're right on that. College libraries are not the way for the OTO to go. They need to publish the damned books in a new edition. I cannot, as a student, afford to shell out $500 for the first edition, which is all that seems to be available sometimes. HB's conception of college-bred Thelema is as stupid as it is naive. I don't remember if it was you or Keith418, but one of you made the comment that students would steal the books if they were in the library. That's absolutely true. I've searched on numerous occasions at the Library of Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana, which is where I study and work, and we have one book, a copy of Crowley's Tao Te Ching. This is pathetic. Where's the Book of the Law? How is the OTO supposed to prosper in the college libraries if the seminal text of the religion isn't available? On another note, there's no complete collection of Crowley's diary, which by now there should be. I think that should be the OTO's number one priority. Publish the diaries of all past AA members. Only in following the footsteps of those who have gone before do we have a chance to avoid the terrors of the abyss. Well, sorry for the length. Sorry for pouring out the black bile of my rage. Love the show. Keep up the work. Love the law. Love under will." Well, I share your pain, and I agree that the ideas that Thelema is going to be bred in the libraries is really foolish. So thanks for your comment. And then the last one is from Tony. Let me play Tony's voicemail first, and then I will read his email. So here's Tony's voicemail.
Hi, John. This is Tony from Texas, and I'm listening to podcast number 41. I just finished with Keith418's interview, and I just had to stop the listening and call you because it certainly brought up a lot of things for me. But before I do that, I just wanted to let you know, thank you very much for your podcast. I've really appreciated them. I've listened to every single one, and I've learned a lot, and I appreciate you sharing. I will be disappointed if you no longer put any out, but I understand how things, they come to life, they have a life, and then at some point that they're put to rest. But going on to Keith418's interview, and one of the items that you discussed was people coming in and out of the occult scene, and they're here, and then they are in for a few years, and then they disappear, and how there seemed to be a lot more activity in the late 80s, early 90s, and I was very active as a pagan during that time, and I'm actually one of those people who came in, was very active, and then disappeared. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I was a lot younger, for one thing. I came in, I was very active. I like to build organizations, and so I was very active building structure and you know, bringing all those middle-class ideals to the organization. And then, you know, things began to change in my life. Got a girlfriend and then a wife. Followed by children, and got tired of the BS of dealing with organizational problems and wanted to turn my attention more to the physical world, and that's what I did. I began to manifest a job and making money and feeding my family and buying a house and being caught up in that whole middle class lifestyle. And in fact, I call myself now a high holy day pagan, because I literally only go to two celebrations a year. I go to Beltane and I go to Samhain. And, you know, I think that at some point when I get older, maybe after I retire or when time gets freed up in my life, I will go back into that because I do believe, go back into being a practicing pagan because I do firmly believe in the ideals behind that. But that's one of the reasons why I'm no longer really there. And you're right, there is a lot of information on the internet and there doesn't seem to be too much activity. And it's sad, but maybe it's just one of those quiet periods. Maybe there was a whole group of people that came in at a certain time and was very active and then got caught up in the rest of their life. Anyway, my thoughts. I really appreciate your podcast. I appreciate your conversation with Keith418, and thank you very much. Bye.
Tony sent a follow-up email in which he writes, "Just left you a voicemail an hour ago. I went ahead and listened to the rest of the podcast. The interview with Keith418 had an effect on me. I was super active for at least 7 years, and then one day I woke up and was tired of being poor. I was tired of all the organizational BS I had to put up with, and I was tired of working with people who didn't really appreciate what I brought to the table. After I stopped being active, my life improved 100%, one of the best decisions I ever made. The parts that I missed of the community and being a spiritual being. I liked working magic. My plan is after I've raised my family and I have fewer physical world demands on my time and attention, I'll be able to practice again. Thanks again for your wonderful podcast, John. I appreciate it a lot, Tony." Well, Tony, thanks for sending the voicemail and the follow-up email. However, I'm going to have to ask you to challenge yourself here, because if you were really serious about being a pagan and or incorporating the magic and spirituality in your life, you would make it more of a priority and you would find time for it. In the end, we only have so much time in the day, and we all prioritize our time differently. That which is important to us is prioritized highly, and that which isn't is low. So, Tony, I really appreciate you taking the time to contact, but if this was really important to you, you would find time in your life now. You wouldn't be waiting until you were less busy before you would turn back to your spirituality, and that you would actually engage in it now, and you would actually do all the things you can. There's no reason that you have to be part of a dysfunctional group. You can look for peers who are serious and educated and capable as you are. And if you can't find a group, you can make a group and only allow people who are serious and interested to be part of it. So I just think this is a bit of a cop-out, Tony. And if you were really interested in this and serious about it, you'd be participating with it in your life now. So maybe that's something for you to think about. And instead of doing these things only on the high holy days, you could figure out a way to reprioritize your life to incorporate these things now. Okay, so that's all of the feedback. And went through a whole bunch of it quickly. So sorry if I didn't read that the most clearly. We have three segments today. First is an interview with William Kiesel of Ouroboros Press. William has put out a number of kind of more grimoire-type books, the first being the half of the translation of The Picatrix, and he has put out some other books. So we talk about the books that he has put out and his future books, and also the production process and how he got into the publishing of this material. The second interview is with Keith418. He and I look at Hegel and Hegel's ideas of the master and slave relationship and also how those affect Thelema and Crowley. And lastly, there is a almost hour interview with David Jones, and he is a practitioner in Oregon, and he has been working quite diligently on Enochian magic for a number of years. And we were lucky enough to get a little bit of his time so he could come on the show and talk a little bit about his Enochian practices, how he sees Enochian work. And we spend particular attention to the Enochian tablets. So those are the three interviews today. So without further ado, let's get into the interview with William Kiesel. We have on the phone with us William Kiesel from Ouroboros Press. Are you there, William?
I am. Thanks, John.
93, welcome to the podcast.
93. I'm glad to be a part of the show.
Now, for those who don't know, Ouroboros Press specializes in kind of older or more, I guess, grimoire-type documents. The first thing that you put out was a translation of the Picatrix. And you have since done the Heptameron and the Turba Philosophorum. How did you start getting into the publishing and then deciding to put out these kinds of books and also in these formats?
Well, originally, John, I wanted to read these works, and the Picatrix particularly, because it just kept coming up in my own research. I think the first time I saw it mentioned was in Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition by Frances Yates. And just some of the passages that she had quoted in there seemed very intriguing to me. And like I say, it just kept coming up in my readings. And, of course, the Warburg had done a German and a Latin edition, but I don't have German or Latin, so I was sort of left hanging, waiting for an English edition to come along. And around the same time, I'd been apprenticing as a bookbinder with Joel Radcliffe of Ars Obscura Bookbinding in Seattle. And Joel had been involved in publishing some esoteric works in the 80s and had some association with Heptangle Press and Acorn Press. And so I was apprenticing with him and learning how to do the binding by hand, and he was the one that suggested that I sort of try to get a project going, and he arranged for me to get the Arabic that was used for the original translation.
Okay. And the other titles that have come up through your press, how did you choose those?
Yeah, the Heptameron and the Arbatel, which are I've published together, they lend themselves well to the aesthetic that I utilize in the press, which is, you know, this medieval and Renaissance topography. I feel like a lot of times the material that I'm dealing with, since it harkens from those previous eras, that I like to invoke the feeling of that era, you know, and I try to account for that in the design of the books. So the Heptameron and the Arbatel, they're classic works that are utilized. You see them quoted often in later, you know, esoteric works, and for a long time you just couldn't get this material.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly not, you know, there's a lot of free texts on the internet, but it's just not the same as holding an actual book in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And the Turba Philosophorum stemmed from my interest in alchemy and Hermetic philosophy, which has been my primary focus in the last several years. And again, just, you know, not being able to get these texts, I found it, you know, it sort of behooved me to make them available, even if it was just so I could read them.
Now,
go ahead.
You do all the layout on all of these, correct?
Yeah, I do all the design and the topography, and but pretty much I do everything except the printing and the binding of the fancy bindings.
Right, and you do put out different versions. You do a general cloth trade edition, and then you also do leather-bound editions?
Yeah, there's a trade cloth edition with printed dust jackets, and then we also issue leather and vellum copies, of course in limited numbers, and those are hand-bound at Ars Obscura.
Mm-hmm.
Joel does really, really nice work.
Okay. And how many of the of each do you do? I mean, obviously it varies but in general.
We usually print about 700 to 1,000 copies of each title.
Okay. And how many of each run are the vellum and or leather?
Well, in the case of the the new book, Return to the Philosophorum, we're only doing a few in vellum because of just the expense of the materials. So only 25 of those were vellum.
Mm-hmm.
And the 275 intended to be bound up in leather, and then the rest, excuse me, the rest will be in the trade cloth edition. So usually the vellum and the leather are much more limited in scope, and then we print the majority of them in the cloth so that, you know, libraries and individuals who are on a budget can afford them.
Mm-hmm. And that has really worked out. I mean, the Picatrix has already sold out in cloth, correct?
Yeah, the cloth edition sold out recently, and I guess it's not too surprising, but the prices on the used market have just sort of shot through the roof, and how far they've shot through the roof, I think, is surprising.
Especially when there are still leather versions available, right?
Yeah. That's the funny thing. You can get a leather version direct from me for a lot less than what the cloth versions are going for on the used market right now.
Well, you know, that, I guess people just don't know that you're out there doing this still. So
I'm just hermited away in my little log cabin, you know, scribing these tomes out.
And what's the next one after the Turbo Philosophorum?
Well, we finally received the complete translation of the second volume of the Picatrix, and so it's in the editorial phase now, and we're really excited. That's going to be an important second volume.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be the next one, and we've got a Natural History of Dragons, which is an English translation of the Dragonobus by Athanasius Kircher, who was a Renaissance Jesuit polymath, and also currently working on a English translation from the Latin of Jocus Severus, which is the Serious Game by Michael Meyer, who was the Emperor Rudolf II's alchemist.
Excellent. Now, you also are selling The God of Socrates. Heptangle Books is no longer around, but you're helping sell off the remaining stock. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, there's still several copies of the last Heptangle Books book available, and it's The God of Socrates. It was the last work that Daniel Driscoll printed before he passed away, and Joel Radcliffe of Ars Obscura had acquired these copies and bound them up, and all of his other works are long out of print and just commanding high prices on the market. And mm-hmm. This is kind of a gem. It's a little more scholarly than some of the other works he'd done. Still nicely printed. It's letterpress printed, and just a little jewel of a book about, you know, the higher genius. It's written by Apuleius, who wrote The Golden Ass. And I was always a fan of Heptangle Press, and so for me, just, you know, distributing this book, it's kind of an honor. I like to put myself as following in their footsteps.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you've offered to give a copy of the Turbo Philosophorum in the cloth edition to one of the Thelema Coast to Coast listeners. So if anybody listening to this is interested in getting a copy, all you need to do is email your mailing address to podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. The deadline for mailing that is July 15th, and that's midnight on July 15th Eastern Time. And after that, one person will be chosen and the book sent to them. And this is open to international listeners also, not just with domestic within the United States. So if you're interested in attempting to win a copy of the Turbo Philosophorum, send in your email, or send in the email with your mailing address. And
William, is there anything else that you'd like people to know about the Ouroboros Press and kind of what you're doing and so forth?
Yeah, we're going to have a book release party for the Turbo Philosophy Forum in New York July 8th.
All right.
Sunday, July 8th at 8 p.m., and that's going to take place at the Stone, which is John Zorn's avant-garde music club, which is on Avenue C and 2nd Street. And I'm going to be giving a presentation on the Alchemical Bestiary, which is going to discuss animal symbolism in alchemy and particularly in its emblems. And there'll be a slideshow of rare books and manuscripts showing these symbols. So I'll be there. I'll be giving the talk, and I'll have all my books there. So if you're in the New York area on the 8th of July, come by and say hi.
Fantastic. Now, if somebody wanted to get in touch with you, how would they do so?
Well, you can reach me through my website, which is www.bookarts.org. Or you can email me direct at ouroboros@bookarts.org. That's OUROBOROS.
All right, and I will have a link to the website on the podcast website.
Great, right. Thanks, John.
Well, thanks for being on the show. Is there anything else you'd like people to know?
I think that's it. I appreciate having the opportunity to be on Thelema Coast to Coast.
Well, this is fantastic. I really love the things that you're doing. I've seen a copy of the Picatrix, and it's just a phenomenal job that you've done. So, I'm sure the winner of the Turbo Philosophy Forum will love it, and I'm sure those who have the first volume of the Picatrix are looking forward to seeing volume two. Now, is there only going to be two volumes in the end, or are there multiple volumes?
Yeah, the second volume will be the completed work. It has the final two books of the Picatrix.
All right. Sounds good. Well, thanks again for being on the show. 93.
Thanks a lot, John. 93.
Thanks to William for being on the show, and thanks again for the offer to one listener to win a copy of the Turbo Philosophy Forum. Again, send your name and your full address to podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. The deadline for entry is 12 midnight on the 15th of July, 2007. So send you that over, and it is open to international listeners also. The next interview is with Keith 418. Most people have listened to the podcast before and are familiar with him. He and I get into and discuss the Hegelian master and slave relationship, as well as its relationship to Thelema. And we have a very interesting conversation. So here it is.
Keith, welcome back to the podcast, 93.
93, John. Thanks for having me.
Recently on your blog, you've been writing about a philosopher named Kojève and his take on Hegel. In particular, you've been concentrating on looking at the Hegelian ideas behind master and slave, Kojève's discussion of that, and comparing that to Crowley and Crowley's ideas of masters and slaves and Thelema. I guess for people that aren't aware, can you give a quick summary about how Hegel sees the master-slave relationship?
Well, Hegel sees a dialectical process happening where the master and slave relationship starts when the master proves that he is sort of more than human by being able to risk death in his objective. And the slave can't bring himself to risk death. So the master actually kind of rises above the natural environment and imposes his will on it and achieves a sort of state of mastery through his willingness to risk death, and then proceeds to enslave the slave who works for him and doesn't want to risk death. And this relationship and the relationship between the masters sets up the paradigm for the ancient world, the pre-Christian or pagan world. And as that society becomes self-conscious, it produces tragic art because it sees certain conflicts as being irreconcilable. And those irreconcilable conflicts which beset it produce tragic art. Christianity is one of a number of ideologies that the slave kind of comes up with to overcome their slave state. And, you know, Hegel defines these ideologies as ways of looking at the possibility of freedom. And the slave moves through various ideologies in classical thinking to Christianity. So I thought this was fascinating, given the fact that as a sort of post-Christian pagan in a lot of ways, Crowley reintroduces the master-slave relationship. And one of the chapters in Magic Without Tears, which ironically is one of these books where Crowley actually explains his system very simply and yet has the current OTO has allowed it to go out of print. It's not a book that very many people cite very frequently in the Thelema community, unfortunately. I mean, you and I seem obsessed with it, but very few other people seem to pay too much attention to it. In one of those chapters, as you know, he lays out why the morality of Liber Al is very hard to accept and why we have to anyway. And he lays out certain definitions about what the human relationships are as defined in his thinking. And he reasserts the master-slave dichotomy very, very explicitly. And I find it fascinating that so many people in the occult community, especially in the OTO, really resist looking at this. I mean, you never hear them talk about the slave gods or slavish behavior, slave mentality, or what distinguishes a master from a slave. And in a lot of ways, there's a great deal of hostility towards anything that's not egalitarian in the Thelemic community. So the idea that Crowley is explicitly saying that this dichotomy exists in human relationships is something that the people in the OTO don't want to hear. I mean, a friend of mine said no one wants to read Magic Without Tears because it keeps telling the Thelema community in the OTO things they do not want to hear. And, you know, reiterating the master-slave relationship as being part of, you know, human relations is definitely something people don't want to hear. So, you know, Hegel looked at this process and said that there's a struggle whereby through Christianity, you know, slaves and masters sort of merge into one class, which is the bourgeoisie. And they're slaves without masters, and that the bourgeoisie don't work directly for a group of other people, and masters without slaves, and that the bourgeoisie really don't have a class of people under them that they're constantly bossing around. Instead, they have this sort of abstract relation to capital. And people can think about, you know, their relationship to their IRA or, you know, sort of where their money is kept, and the idea of accumulating capital is this sort of abstract situation that they relate to. And of course, this is picked up later by Marx. And, you know, one of your guests has been on the show before, T. Allen Greenfield, has often pointed out that Crowley got a lot of his ideas for the OTO from Hegel. And I didn't believe that. I didn't pay too much attention to it until I went and started studying Hegel, and I found out that Allen Greenfield was right about that. He really did get, I think, some of these ideas from that. So, you know, we're looking back at this now and saying, well, what kind of relationship are we going to have in a Thelemic community between masters and slaves, and how are we going to look at how masters are defined and how slaves are defined, and what the relationship is going to be coming away from that?
Well, one of the things that I think is very interesting about this relationship is a lot of the people that have anxiety about the discussion of masters and slaves think that the masters are somehow going to enslave others, you know, that there's going to be some kind of violent oppression that one person is going to exert on another to enslave them, you know, reminiscent of the African slaves and things in the past that most people object to. But I think what's important to point out is that that's not the case at all, that the masters are going to self-select by their willing to take risks, and that the slaves are going to self-select by their willing to not take risks, to take the safe course. And therefore, you know, people come to their own equilibrium, and it's not one person enslaving another.
Well, I don't know if that's really going to be the case, John. I mean, I can't say that for sure. In fact, I think some of the tests that go on in terms of self-selecting process come about through crises where you're faced with certain questions about how you're going to behave, and that those crises are brought on at the instigation of other people. So that the idea that it's going to be a sort of self-selecting process that goes on naturally without other human beings being involved in the process, I wouldn't go so far as to say that, because I think that that those crises and that relationship is actually part of the self-selecting process.
Well, again, I'm not saying that other people aren't going to be involved. I'm saying that you're not going to have roving bands of people grabbing others and enslaving them in chains, and that you're going to have people fighting to get out of that. Instead, you're going to have people who are presented with certain circumstances. You know, you may be put in a crisis situation by others. So, I mean, there are definitely going to be people involved, but it's not the kind of violent overthrow, I think, that a lot of people think of when they hear masters and slaves.
Yeah, I'm not going to rule that out.
Well, how does Crowley see it a little differently than Hegel?
Well, Hegel saw the master-slave dichotomy sort of forcing itself into a resolution, and ultimately he thought that human beings would pass beyond Christianity by making the Christian ideal of equality and ending the tension between, you know, various classes and struggles in one gigantic state, a total state, in which all of these crises would become resolved because everyone would be valued and everyone's work and effort would be considered important within the context of this absolutely total state. And he thought that Christianity ultimately fulfilled itself in what, you know, I think we would look at as some sort of totalitarian society. And I don't know if Crowley really believed that. I know Nietzsche certainly was skeptical about it, and I think instead that they saw a sort of constant battle between, you know, the various classes just going on forever, and that tension, you know, was just part of life. Now, we also have to be careful about what point in Crowley's life would he be observing this. And I think, you know, one of the things about Magic Without Tears that makes it difficult for people is that it was written at the end of his life, and he contradicts some of the things that he said earlier on. And I think at the, you know, in the early 1900s, you know, right around 1918, 1917, 1919, we see Crowley thinking that the OTO is going to be a system that's going to take over the United States, that it's going to become a very strong institutional structure, or even a countercultural institution, or, you know, he says it in some letters that he thinks that it's going to catch on throughout the United States, and people in positions of secular power are going to see that it's the system that's going to work. And then, you know, much time goes by, and in the 40s, he was very skeptical about group activities, and you can see that skepticism very strongly expressed in Magic Without Tears. So at one point, I mean, I think it might not be off base to say that Crowley thought that the OTO was a version of Hegel's total system, and it certainly somewhat looks like that. And then, you know, in the 40s, he's basically saying, no, you know, the lemma is really about the individual, the group, the sect, the clan doesn't count for anything. He says the individual is the sole autarch. And again, I mean, this is one of the things in Magic Without Tears that people really have a problem with. I don't really see the community being as supportive of the totality of the individual as it used to be, because I think that it's seen that when you say that, you can't protect yourself from criticism. You can't. Only very strong people are really going to react positively to that sort of metaphysical imperative. So, you know, I think it bears more study. I think it's fascinating, because I don't really think Crowley ever wanted a total resolution the way Hegel did. I think in the 40s he was content to say, hey, you know, there's going to be certain people who will only band together when there are crises that force them to, and the rest of the time they're not going to want to work together, and they're going to be skeptical of group activity. And that's, I think, very, very interesting. I mean, Hegel also pointed out that there's always going to be conflict between the family and the state. The family loves you for what you are, regardless of what you do. The state only values your activity. So there, you know, he saw in the pagan state, the pre-Christian pagan state, a conflict between familial obligations and roles, and the roles of the society, that you were either true to your family and betray the state, or you were going to be true to the state and betray your family. And he thought that was the source of the pagan tragic worldview. You know, whether that can ever be resolved in an integrated hierarchical system with slaves and masters within the Thelema context, I don't know. And I think that at one point Quilley sort of conceived of it as an organic state where that kind of hierarchy could exist, and at other times I think he despaired of group workings only because he saw that people would start to, you know, fall prey to the mass mind and the conformity demands of the group.
Well, I think he also looked at the distraction. I mean, when he was disparaging the groups, he's like, you know, people just get together and I think he just criticized each other's hats.
Yeah, yeah, it's not, and then the work suffers because of that. And so he was much more, in Magic Without Tears, you see him telling people, like, you know, you only get together when you absolutely have to, and if you don't have to, you don't need to. But, you know, we see this in context because he was dealing with the problems at Agape Lodge and the problems that he was having with people in America and in various places with their negative group dynamics going on. And people can read The Red Flames, which discuss that period to get a better idea of what sort of, you know, chaos and problems were going on in that community.
Well, and in some ways, we still have a bunch of those kind of problems happening today.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the conflict in the OTO, is how does a group of Thelemites work together? And many people say things like, well, you know, trying to get Thelemites to work together is like trying to herd cats. We hear this all the time. And group projects and group work is often very difficult in the Thelemic community. I think it's difficult because I don't think people really understand what's involved with it, and that they're confusing egalitarian and normative values with Thelemic values. But regardless, it's not something that's, you know, been resolved for us, and it's something that I think most people are putting off resolving for themselves, and usually they just give up.
Well, I think there's also the aspect of it that a lot of the group workings are not really goal-oriented. I mean, like, for instance, if they do a group ritual, it's more about doing the group ritual and having some kind of cohesiveness and fraternity and camaraderie in doing the ritual than actually achieving anything with the ritual itself.
Right, and, you know, part of the issue with that is that magical results are easy to disconfirm. I mean, they lend themselves to, you know, being undermined or questioned. And so often what you'll see is people who start out trying to do stuff with magic settle for the byproducts of those workings, which are, you know, exchange of affect within the group. And, again, I mean, there's a movement towards making the group the most important thing, and the social instinct begins to take over rather than, you know, what I think we were to look at, which is, you know, the individual will. And, you know, we've been talking a lot recently about how people are looking for this sort of group acceptance, and they're ready to sacrifice any sort of individuality or individual perspective in order to get to it, which I don't think is healthy, and I don't think is particularly Thelemic, but, you know, it is part of the process.
Well, where do you think, you know, Hegel falls in with the, you know, the kind of the edicts within the Book of the Law about, you know, trample down the wretched and the weak and all of this very martial dichotomy between the master and the slave?
Well, I don't pretend to be an expert on Hegel, but I do think that, you know, we can ask ourselves whether or not Crowley really wanted to eliminate slaves entirely, or a purpose and a place for them within the society that he conceived as Thelemic. And on the one hand, you know, I get the idea that people are unhappy with the idea of there being any slaves at all, and that in a perfect Thelemic society there would be no slaves. And I think this is somewhat foolish. It's like the people who think you can have perfect Jeffersonian democracy without a slave society. And I think that's foolish, too, because it's failing to look at the historical determinants that created Jefferson and Jeffersonian ideals for democracy. He was sitting there in a plantation that was being run and worked on by slaves. And when I see, for example, conservative people arguing that we should return to this Jeffersonian thing, they don't talk about the historical determinants that created that, which I think is silly. But, you know, do we want to eliminate slavery entirely as Thelemites? Or is Thelema coming to eliminate slavery and free everybody? Or is Thelema there to free the people who can handle it? And that's really it. And that's the problem, because the egalitarian impulse coming from Christianity is that there should be no slaves at all, that everyone should be equal. And I don't really know if that's what Crowley is talking about or what he was really interested in. And I think, unfortunately, that's where people tend to disagree with him, and then the system begins to collapse as they remove one structure after another that he put in place in order to get back to their egalitarian ideals, the ones that they're comfortable with, the ones that they get from normative society.
So you're saying it's kind of hard to have or implement the Thelemic ideal unless you have this kind of class system of the dichotomy between those who are willful and those who are fearful.
Well, I think the difficulty that you're seeing over and over again with this is that people want a egalitarian society, and they think that that's the only just one. So if they really are committed to that, why are there ranks and degrees and a hierarchy within a group, say, like the OTL? And you see this tension develop, because on the one hand, everyone thinks Thelema is about equality, and on the other hand, the system is set up to be completely unequal. So how do they resolve that conflict and that tension? And there's, you know, there's hypocrisies that go on where, you know, the people who are the most ferocious about equality issues are the ones who are, you know, coveting these upper degrees, which once they get, they, you know, are very happy to have. And so there really hasn't been any consensus within the community that equality is not something we should be all seeking, but the structure of their very community itself is one that's not equal. So I don't know how they're going to resolve that. And, you know, is that the same thing as masters and slaves? Well, not entirely, because people can say, you know, we're not trying to enslave the Minervals of the first degrees. But it definitely isn't an equal situation.
Right. So, you know, whether it's a master or slave, it's definitely a hierarchy of some kind and basically anti-egalitarian.
Right. And that's the problem, because as long as people have this anti-egalitarian attitude going on, they'll never be happy with the OTO. And if they're not happy with the OTO and the way that it's structured and the designs that Crowley had for it, they won't commit to it. And if they won't commit to it, they won't donate money to it, they won't donate time to it, they won't take it seriously. It becomes a game or an exercise in pursuing the exchange of affect or, you know, whatever. But it's not serious, and it's not something that, you know, people are going to take seriously enough to manifest. So this is this conflict that goes on. And the leaders of the group, I don't really think, have made up their minds either about this. On the one hand, you know, they want the hierarchy, and on the other hand, they keep stepping away from it and saying, oh, you know, I don't really feel that we're leaders. I don't really feel that I'm not happy with these titles, whatever line they're trying to pull. So they want the best of both worlds, and they wind up with the worst of both and the best of neither. If they seem authoritarian, and yet they can't really do anything with their authority, you know, and they push equality, but they don't really have the benefit of it because they don't have a system that's set up to be equal.
Well, you know, the other problem they have is they insist that, you know, the members look up to the leaders and respect them and everything. But then if people feel that everyone's equal, they're not going to, you know, or they'll just give it lip service. And even if the leaders are, you know, have an egalitarian mindset, then they're not going to really see themselves as that different from those of the lower degrees, and therefore they're not going to really kind of push on them or challenge them, which is why we kind of have this mush that exists today.
Right, and this is why I think going back and looking at writers like Hegel and like Nietzsche, you know, who did see the necessity of unequal relations and did see the importance of a hierarchy, and did look at the world without the need to see it in this particular way is important. You know, Nietzsche challenged Hegel's idea of what a fulfilled Christianity would be like by attacking the whole system of Christian morality to begin with. But it's, at the same time, it's very difficult not to see a sort of Hegelian process going on now where the most Christian people are often the ones who, yeah, to me anyway, don't really believe in God, but are trying to manifest a perfectly equal total state here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Oswald Spengler once said that Christianity was the God, the grandmother of communism, or Bolshevism, and I can see what he's, you know, where he's coming from with that. You know, the idea that everyone should be equal and there should be a huge state taking care of everyone that we all participate in seems to me like it really comes from Christianity. And if you don't believe that, if you're, you know, opposed to that sort of ultimate model, then you also have to look at, you know, the origins of your values and where they come from. And, you know, Crowley was very opposed to communism. You know, he once said that the Thelema is, you know, best advantage was that it was the only ideology that could go up against communism. In a post-communist world, you know, we might laugh at that, but I still think it has a lot of value, a lot there to teach us.
Well, one of the things that we mentioned earlier that we really haven't explained is why Christianity would appeal to the slaves. You know, we would say that they use that as some kind of escape, and I think it goes back to your ideas about the tragic. And
right. Well, Hegel, you know, basically makes the case that the Christianity is opposed to the tragic worldview because it seeks a resolution. You know, the slave might be a slave and might be suffering from unequal relations in life, but upon death, he goes up to heaven and achieves this, you know, this state of equality with everyone else, and doesn't have to worry about that anymore, that Jesus and God take care of you in the end anyway. And this eliminates the tragic worldview because it does provide a resolution. It just provides a resolution in death. And Hegel basically says, you know, that's not what we experience. I mean, no one experiences death in heaven enough to make that a legitimate ideology. So, in other words, in order to fulfill itself, Christianity has to get away from this emphasis on the afterlife and instead try to manifest a real kingdom of heaven here on earth, which would be a total state in which everyone would be taken care of and everyone would be equal, and we would find a balance between, you know, the way we're pulled in various directions by loyalties and everything else in our lives. And that's what, you know, Hegel ultimately saw Christianity heading to, was this total state. And, you know, is there going to be another kind of total state that's unequal? Are there going to be smaller states that war against each other and recapitulate pagan relationships and the pagan tragic worldview? I mean, one of the questions I keep having is, Thelemites fight with each other all the time. And if there was, you know, Thelemic slave states and little Thelemic masters and feudal roles to play, wouldn't there be these conflicts breaking out constantly? And wouldn't the Thelemic masters have to prove themselves by willing to risk death to advance their projects, etc., wouldn't that necessitate a return to the sort of pagan worldview? This is this idea I've been playing with. And, you know, I don't know how you could avoid that from a certain perspective.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop. You know, we're throwing out a lot of ideas for people to think about and kind of mull over themselves and see what their own
emotional. One of the concerns I would have, I would challenge your listeners who are pagans, is to look at the pagan tragic worldview and wonder why neo-paganism isn't interested in it, for the most part. Why neo-pagans have continued to have a sort of happy-ending Christian worldview to everything, and why they haven't rediscovered the tragic worldview. Alain de Benoist brings this up in his book on being a pagan. And I think it's something that they could stand to look at. If they're not Thelemites, if they're pagans, they need to ask themselves, are they really pagans? Are they interested in a pagan tragic worldview? Or are they really more Christians than they are pagans?
Well, I think Thelemites should ask themselves the same question.
I would agree.
So, all right, well, thanks again for being on the show, 93.
Thanks for having me, John.
Thanks again to Keith418 for being on the show. Lastly, David Jones is a longtime Enochian practitioner and has written a number of articles that can be found on the internet, especially on hermetic.com. Here's David talking about Enochian magic, and in particular, the Enochian tables.
We have on the phone with us David R. Jones. Are you there, David?
I am here.
Welcome to the podcast, 93.
93. Doeth those through the whole of law.
Love is the law. Love under will. There's a lot of writing about Enochian on the internet, and there's a lot of references to the Enochian work that you have done. So I've wanted to have you on the show to talk a little about that. At one time, you published some articles in the Sekhmet Lodge newsletter, and those are on the website. And I started reading some of those, and it was very interesting on how you kind of broke down the Enochian system into three parts: zodiacal, planetary, elemental, and then you started systematically going through those. So I wanted to ask you some questions about that.
Mm-hmm.
First, how did you kind of come up with that, the three-part system, seeing them as zodiacal, and what do you associate with the zodiacal and the planetary and elemental and so forth?
The principle of attacking any magical system that way first came to me from Ebony Onfu, and he had this idea called the three realms of magic, And as I started exploring grimoire magic, and particularly Agrippa, who's one of the first persons to systematize Renaissance magic in any sort of clarified way, I saw that pretty much all systems of grimoire magic are based on this division. And so I looked at the Enochian system because I knew that Dee was adept at using Agrippa's system. He was familiar with it. He frequently notes it in the marginalia to his stuff. He talks about it in some depth. And I associated the two things and found out that indeed that the Enochian system fit into this model, because there were sets of 12, sets of 7, and sets of 4 and 5. And when you see sets of 12, sets of 7, sets of 4 and 5, it's usually a dead giveaway that they are astrological, planetary, and elemental,
mm-hmm.
in those orders. And there are other little things that clues that you have along the way. If they start talking about planets, which Dee does, or they use the archangels that are traditionally associated with governments of ours, you can be pretty sure they're planetary.
Mm-hmm.
When you see tribes of Israel, especially ones that are associated with the directions, then you can be pretty sure that there's some underlying zodiacal system. The Sefer Yetzirah talks about this to some degree, and a lot of the Renaissance magic is based from the Sefer Yetzirah into Kabbalistic magic. It's intrinsic in Kabbalistic magic in general. So that's originally how I attacked the problem. Once you've divided them up that way, then what they do is a little bit more ambiguous, but elemental issues tend to relate to physical reality around you. Planetary are a little more esoteric. They tend to imply forces that are active in your universe and that move around, which are differentiated, say, from the building in which you live. Love, war, hatred, one's will, even wealth on a sort of generic sense are all sort of forces, things that come through one's life and are more related to planetary forces. Zodiacal forces are more background information on some level, but they also relate to larger, more cosmic phenomenon, but also to who we are as human beings. So that on some level they're personal. But they also, both zodiacal and planetary issues relate to timing issues too. You find that in the ethers in particular, you find that there are zodiacal attributions that you can derive from the governors. And they have a lot to do with timing issues for how the ethers work more efficiently than at other times. Jim Eshelman actually wrote a fairly detailed series on how the vision of the voice relates to zodiacal issues in, I think it's called The Black Pearl, I think it's his publication. Mm-hmm. And if you look at my system, you can sort of track it. The idea is that each governor has an angel who rules over it. Each angel is ascribed to a tribe. Each tribe is thereafter ascribed to a zodiacal sign. And so that at any given time of the day, there are four astrological signs above the horizon. And I argue, if you look at the Enochian system and look at the ethers, that the implication there is that you would desirably call those ethers when those signs are above the horizon. And if you look at when Crowley has trouble getting into the ethers, as Eshelman points out, and which I've verified to some degree, the more trouble he has is when he's not cognizant. I don't think he's ever cognizant of that, but I think he accidentally gets it right most of the time. And it's not that hard a trick to get right, because they're fairly long periods of time. So on a given day, a good quarter of the day, those three signs are going to be above the horizon. That makes any sense.
Right, and you figure that out by a governance of the hours, and you set up...
Well, the governance of hours is a different issue. Governance of hours is a planetary issue. I mean, you have to learn the basics of astrology and know what's above the horizon at any given moment. It's constantly in flux.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the rising sign is based on. The rising sign is, or the horoscope is based on, what is directly due east at a given moment, and then half of the sky is going to be above the horizon. Half of these zodiacal signs, between 6 and 8, are going to be above the horizon, either in toto or in part, because you could have half a sign on one horizon, half a sign at the other horizon. I guess 7 is all you can probably have at any given moment, and that's moving. And each sign takes 2 hours to transit above the horizon, so and so they're above the any given signs above the horizon 12 hours during the day.
So you suggest that, let's say, you know, you're going to work a particular ether,
mm-hmm.
you should find out when it's above the horizon, and in general, anywhere above the horizon is fine.
Just right. When the three governors who rule that, when the three governors who rule that ether are above the horizon.
Okay.
It's more problematic with the two ethers where there are four above the horizon. And they are problematic in various kinds of ways, Texan, Perron, and Lin. And so there's a sequential issue there. There's a quadrature going on there, and I think that one has to sort of, you can get all four of them above the horizon, but it's going to be for a fairly narrow stretch of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can work each governor individually to get at those ethers, as opposed to trying to get all three of them above the horizon at a given time.
So you're saying if you're working the ethers that you look at whatever governor, like if they're not all going to be sequentially above, then you work with, you look to the, and call upon that governor or that ether when it's above the horizon.
Yeah, but they're all, like I said, with the exception of two ethers, there is a time during any given day
where all of them are.
Where all three of the ones attributed to that ether will be above the horizon, sure.
Okay.
It has to be. It's the nature of the way 12s work and the way division works.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a fact of astronomical geometry.
Well, let's look a little more. I mean, a lot of people work with the ethers, since that's what Curly did. And fewer people, you know, go in and look at the other things. Now, you say that the elemental or the watchtowers are what a good number of people have worked with. So why don't we spend a little time looking at the watchtowers?
Okay.
Now, you assert that there's a direct relationship between the watchtowers shown on the golden talisman and the four watchtower tablets and also the relationship to the Book of Revelation.
Yes, I assert that. I mean, I'm not the only one who asserts it. Tyson makes that pretty blunt assertion, too.
Mm-hmm.
The Golden Dawn, to some degree, tried to distance themselves from that by substituting the Chaldean oracles in places where they had problems with the Book of Revelation. But if you read the diaries, you read it through in Faithful Relation, you will see that there are numerous quotes from the Book of Revelation that are assigned to these places. So I think it's relatively obvious. The most obvious part about it is the kings, who have six wings, and there are six lines that proceed out of the king's name, and which give you the six seniors, and the Enochian system says rather bluntly that the six seniors times four are the 24 elders or seniors in the Book of Revelation. And so that's central to the system, and everything else sort of revolves around that. It's a really obvious piece of symbolism, and I don't know how else you can take it.
Mm-hmm. Now, doesn't that have implications about the Judaic and the specifically Christian nature of the Enochian system? Do you think it's a problem if somebody isn't a Christian to work with these?
I don't know. Maybe. When I first started working with it, I didn't have any problems with it. But as I moved along, I found myself, yes, I'm buying on some level into a Christian paradigm on one level. I mean, certainly Christian Gnosticism is harmonious with a system, so there's not a problem there. But, and so is, in fact, the OTO. I mean, Thelema, Crowley makes this point somewhere along in one of the secret documents that none of us is supposed to read, that the central secret of OTO is also a Christian secret. So one can come, and what's interesting about this, too, you also see Satanists who use this, but they're also working in a Christian paradigm, whether they like to accept that or not. They're working sort of in an inverse Christian paradigm. There's a lot of Christianity in this. I don't know to what degree one has to accept a doctrinal point of view about Christianity. One has to become, say, a Catholic or, you know, D was Anglican, I'm Anglican, you know, so it's all harmonious for me. But we have what we call latitudinarian point of view. We accept pretty much, you know, a very wide variety of opinions about what Christianity happens to mean. So in interpreting Revelation is one of those bugaboos that has, assaulted Christian theologians since the time of, you know, it was written in the early second century probably. So you know, each person has to interpret that for themselves, but you're stuck with the fact that, yes, indeed, there is a Christian paradigm going on here. And so you must at least understand it in terms of the Christian paradigm. One's own belief is an entirely different issue.
Okay. Well, let's start looking at a little bit of the Watchtower system. Now, let's back up and say, where did the actual watchtowers come from? What are they built out of? Or you know, all of the various letters, characters, shapes, where is all of that coming from? Obviously, it's some kind of revelation from,
right,
from Kelly, but, you know, it's more systematic than that. Can you give a little background on how each part is built and how they relate to each other?
Okay, not to belabor the point about the whole history of Enochian, but Dee and Kelly started a sequence of, I think, about 1584. They started this series of scrying enterprises, beginning in essentially with planetary magic. They started out actually doing planetary magic, and Liber Secundus, for instance, which is the second series in their books, is where the sigillum comes out. And they do this for a long, long, long period of time. And gradually they get more and more information, more and more detailed information, and the system shifts around. Somewhere towards the end, actually, I would, you know, if you were to look at the whole bulk of the system, it's probably about three-quarters of the way through the whole experience with Dee and Kelly, they start getting the keys, the 19 keys, depending on how you look at them, which were in a language which they called angelic. It wasn't the first time they had received angelic language. They had received it prior to this in a book called Logaeth, but it had never been fully translated in that place. And this place, they started getting these calls or keys, which were translated. They would get a long series. Sometimes they would get them in pieces. Sometimes they first started receiving them backwards, and then they started receiving them forwards, and then they would get little pieces of the translation. And in the midst of this, they started receiving tables. Dee has a vision where, Kelly has a vision where he sees a bunch of dots on a table. It's a clay table he sees first. And the dots get connected. And so he starts seeing squares. And then he starts seeing what he calls pricks in the middle of each one of them. And they themselves also get connected into little squiggles, which are the squiggles we later recognize as the sigils of the governors of the ethers. But prior to that, they had actually received this list of ethers and this list of governors of ethers. And then they started receiving, after they got the pricks, they started receiving the tables line by line. And what was interesting about that was that they already had this list over here of 91 governors, right? The 91 governors who rule over the ethers. And they have this diagram with all these squiggles on it. And then they have this set of four tables given in sequence line by line. Well, when they matched the list of governors that they had previously with the squiggles to the letters in the watchtowers, they found that they largely agreed. It's not a perfect match, but it's incredibly close. I think the deviance is about 8 or 9 letters throughout the whole system. So in the case, there's 156 letters on each tablet. So roughly 700 plus letters, only 9 of them deviated between these three lists. Mm-hmm. And so that's how the watchtowers came to be the way that they are. That makes sense?
Yes. And then the names of the governors, though, were not written lineally on it. They're traced out in different patterns that give the sigils.
Right, but they were originally given as just a set of names. They were originally, that's the first piece of information they have, is this list of 91 weird, mm-hmm. weird-sounding names.
Right, but when they got the table, that you know,
they got the squiggles between the table and the sigils between the table and the linear rendering of the tables.
Right, and that was kind of the point on how it's kind of, you know, miraculous, I guess you might say.
Kind of miraculous, yeah. It's certainly a feat of, if Kelly concocts it, it's certainly an incredible feat of memory. And I know the details of the Enochian system as well as most people in the world do, and you know, as far as having gone over to memorize it, and I couldn't pull that off by any long stretch of the imagination, even though I know most of the names, know good percentages of the watchtowers by heart, and I would be lost trying to do that. So yeah, it's one of those demonstrations of something's going on. Certainly, Kelly had a vast and a prodigious mind, if assuming that both Kelly and Dee aren't in on some kind of scam here, and there's no reason to suspect that they are.
Well, let's look at the connection to the Book of Revelation. So you end up getting all of these governor names. They make up the table, and there's four tables of 156 each, and then they're connected by a cross, which makes the table of union.
Yeah.
So how do you determine which table was what? I mean, obviously, when you see the number four, you start matching it up to the elementals, and you start matching
it. Oh, yeah, right, okay. Well, there's a diagram that helps you out with that. There's a diagram that associates the angels to the... There's several ways of doing it, actually. There's a couple of visions that they have, which are a little ambiguous, but there's one where they have... Well, there's several times where they interact with what are called these... The one that's on the golden talisman, for instance, is an example, but it's only one of about three times where this occurs, where carpets or banners are dropped of four different colors. And you see this sort of lengthy hierarchy is sort of explicated there without too much detail, other than you see the king and his ministers and, you know, princes and whatever else falls after him. Then there's what's called the round table vision, where there's four doors painted different colors, and they open the doors. Inside those doors are representations of the four elements. One's wind, one's water, and one's fire, and one's dirt, actually soot or something like that. So all four of them are straight up elements, one of the four, you know, traditional Aristotelian elements. And then there are several tables which attribute the 12 tribes to the directions, and by aligning those to the known astrological values, and it's a pretty simple astrological system, Aries is one, Taurus is two, etc., you find out that all the elements astrologically then get piled up also in these very same directions, so that all the air signs are in the east, you know, and this varies a little bit, and it changes through the system. There's some movement going on here. But by attaching that to the initial reception of the watchtowers, you find that air is in the... I think initially air is in the east, earth is in the south, water is in the west, and fire is in the north, I think, in the initial system. And that matches the colors and matches the round table vision. So you have these sort of systematic things. You have an astrological system by which you know the value of the signs. You know that Aries is fire, and Taurus is earth, and Gemini is air. You have these colors which follow Revelation, which I point out. You know, there's colors of these horsemen in Revelation, the same four colors, and they can be pretty clearly attributed to the cardinal signs of those elements. I mean, there's a sheep in one place. It's obviously Aries is a ram. There's a guy holding scales, which is the scales lever, which is on one side, and then the other side he's holding a spike of wheat, which is Spica, which is Virgo, which is earth. There's the bowman, which is pretty straight up Sagittarius, which is fire. So, I mean, there are these correlations, and then there's the round table, and you open the door, and it's the same color. It opens up, it's red, and inside there's wind, so that's got to be air. You open up white, inside there's flames, that's got to be fire. Et cetera. So there's a systematic way of attributing those tables that you're given at first to elemental values.
Well, let's stop there for a second, because already there's obvious a direct kind of contradiction to what the Golden Dawn was setting up with. I mean, there's obviously no yellow here.
Oh, the color schema. Yeah, no, the color schema is different. The Golden Dawn has its own color schema. The Golden Dawn system certainly isn't... The problem with the Golden Dawn system is it's kind of like coding. I always think Golden Dawn magicians are like Mac users, and people who follow these diaries are sort of PC users. I don't think it's completely erroneous, but I'm a fundamentalist on this level. I'm trying to replicate as best I can what I get from D. They use a different system of colors, partially because colors... In the Renaissance, colors were less vivid. We didn't have chemistry, and so they had a very basic set, a very basic palette of colors that they used for dyeing, for instance. The Golden Dawn is trying to be somewhat more inclusive. And the interesting thing about the Golden Dawn system is you get all three primary colors in both palettes, in both, in both light and pigment. If you use at least Crowley's redaction of the Golden Dawn colors, because the three primary colors in pigment are red, yellow, and blue, and the three primary colors in light, I think, are they red?
Red, green, and blue.
Yeah, right, exactly. So you've got the full set there. And if you look at, say, something like the king, queen, prince, princess scale in the Golden Dawn, you can see how important those pigment values are to them. So that's what they work from. It's just not what I do. I don't know that it's wrong. It's just not how I approach the problem.
So even when you create the tables, you use the color scheme of black, white, red, and green.
Yes, I do.
Instead of the Golden Dawn's attributions.
That's correct.
And you carry that through the whole system when you're using elementals. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So, well, let's look a little more into the what you're saying, that the watchtowers are actually connected with the four horsemen, and I think at one point you say in here that some of this is about bringing about the apocalypse or something of that nature?
Well, that's the argument, that's sort of like I pointed out, the labeling that's on the system. The system itself claims that's what it's doing.
So when people are working Enochian, and they're actually working towards bringing the apocalypse?
That's what the angels say, yeah.
Okay.
What exactly that means has been, like I said before, it's been a great question of Christian theology for the last, over 1900 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Even the early Christians were confused by what that meant, so no less are we confused by it. I don't think it's, the Hal Lindsey, late great planet Earth, or I don't know if you watched the 3ABN Book of Daniel interpretation from the Seventh-day Adventist. I don't think it's something. We have this tendency to adopt what's called a premillennialist. This is the most prevalent view of the Book of Revelation. People, Christians who talk about it in a premillennialist way. We can blame Crowley's teacher, Crowley's father's teacher, Mr. Darby, for this. Premillennials. Flame is very influenced by it too. The terminology you see in the Book of the Law is again also this same apocalyptic terminology from Revelation. I mean, and other prophetic books. The desolation of abomination is a term from Daniel. The beast, a term from Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
The great whore. All these things are ideas that Crowley. He identifies himself with a great beast, with Therion, so he sees himself as an apocalyptic figure too. I don't see that there's a
that's necessarily the interpretation that you have to go by.
Well, I mean, I do. I think you have to see it in those terms. I think you have to see it in terms of what Christian apocalypse is all about. But I don't know that you have to interpret it the way that most fundamentalist Christians would interpret it.
Okay. Well, in another essay, you talk about the attribution of the keys to the various tables. And a lot of people will look at the first 18 keys and take the first two for spirit, and then the next four to one table, the next four to one table,
the next
four. Yes,
that's the Golden Dawn way of doing it.
Right. But
I'm not sure whether Mathers or Westcott came out with that one. It's a mechanical method of doing it, of applying them. And I applied it for a long time that way, too. And the thing is, if you read the keys, things will happen, and so people have this tendency to think, well, see, it worked. But, just because things happen doesn't mean it worked. And I think it's improperly attributed, and a friend of mine and I started systematically going through it and trying to look at what it was directionally, and I think it's fairly clear that it's a directional device and not a key device and not a device that's attributed by table the way that the Golden Dawn does it, because if you do it the way the Golden Dawn does it, you come up with directions that don't match. You'll be calling angels in the south while you're facing north.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a dilemma. In theory, by my understanding, if the key says that a certain direction is to be faced, then that direction should probably be the direction that you're facing. And I think you can get something very close to that with one minor problem. by just reading the keys as if they're starting in the east and going clockwise, 1, 2, 3, 4, back to the east, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc.
So it's almost kind of this circular or spiral.
Yeah, it's a circular pattern. And most of the Watchtower system in particular is divided this way. It's divided into circles and squares, and, you know, it's a basic Masonic principle on some levels, too. You have a square and a compass, and so you've got circles and you've got squares. So, when you're building any building, that's what you have to start with. You know, you circumscribe the area you're working in, and you start dividing it up by right angles. Buildings don't stand very well if they're not, you know, built right angles until you get steel and you can actually start skewing off in different directions. But most of the buildings we live in are nice square boxes.
Or some variation thereof.
Yeah, boxes above boxes. Certainly King Solomon's Temple is. Certainly the Tabernacle is. Almost all Western magical systems go back to the Temple of Solomon and the Tabernacle. And Enochian is no different.
Okay, so now we've gone over, you know, how the tables were constructed, and referencing
it. Before we go on there, if people are going to understand the Watchtower system, which is probably where you should begin, even though it's sort of the end of the system, the system itself, I surmise, sort of begins up in the astrological space and sort of descends, and so that in a symbolic way, so that the very end of the system is a terrestrial system. And so people who get attacked the manuscript occasionally say, oh, we need to start over here back in the beginning. But in fact, the end is the place to start.
And work your way back.
Yes. True and Faithful's out there. It's online now. I forget which website's out there, but I think Ian Rons, I think his name is, has a PDF version of a True and Faithful. And if people are going to work the Watchtowers, they need to sort of isolate, and I give people notes in my articles as to where those places are in the Watchtowers. Lon Duquette's new book will have notes by me. I think he's quoting me a lot, apparently. And saying where those are in True Faithful, people should actually read that text to sort of understand it. I can't tell people enough to do that. And unfortunately, there's Latin in there, and I'm sorry that everybody doesn't speak Latin. That's not really my problem. They should learn Latin. But there's enough English in there that they can figure it out for themselves. And they need to go over that material, as tough as it is sometimes, three or four times, to try to understand what's going on there.
Okay. So somebody is interested in working with, you know, just this. And let's kind of, like, put the Golden Dawn stuff aside. And so the Watchtowers are constructed with the black, white, red, and green. And
I have white and black. I have black and white tables. They're an inch square each. I think there's good reason for having the squares at an inch size, because that gives you a foot on one side, 13 inches on the other. And so you can then derive the inch from it by swinging the arc across. And I think that there's a underlying system of English measures coded into the system. And then I have banner. I have a clause, a passage. I have four claws of passage in the appropriate colors.
Okay, so your tables are actually black and white.
My tables are black and white, and I hang my banner, my claws of passage, and I put the tower on top of it.
Now, when you say a banner, are you talking a long piece of cloth that you hang on the wall?
Yes, a long piece of cloth I hang on the wall.
And then you put the table above it?
On top, right in the middle of it.
Okay, and then what do you do with the table of union?
I have one of those. I put it in the middle, in my central altar. I cram a lot of stuff in the central altar, and I pile them according to what I'm actually doing.
Okay, so you don't just have the Table of Union. You have a lot of other.
I have a sigil. I've got a Nalvej. I've got a round table of Nalvej, and I've got other. What are other tables I'm working from? Sometimes I'll make. I have tables appropriate to the seniors. Which just have their six names on them, their 6x7s. I have tables of the archangels and the angels derived from the sigillum, which are 7x7. So depending on what I'm doing, I the sigillum is almost always the base, and then a crystal ball, and then I have other tables depending on what I'm doing. Even when I'm working with a Watchtower, I tend to haul out some other stuff, either Nalvaj or an archangelic table.
Now, how large is your full table, you know, that has the square and the seven seals on it and everything? Is that your, is that just the top of your altar?
Yeah, it's a whole table. I have a piece of oak wood that I, it was supposed to be a single piece, but they actually made it two pieces and glued it together. But, yeah, and it's, whatever the measure says there, I think it's a 3 feet by 3 feet. I forget how big it is. It's about, yeah, it's, I think it's a cubit and a half, I think it is. I'd have to see exactly. There's a measurement given in cubits. Cubits are 18 inches. But the measurement of the table actually is the interior of the table, apart from the border, which has the letters on it. I don't think I've ever, I have a lengthy argument about how the Holy Table is supposed to be constructed, taken from Liber Primus mainly and Liber Quinti appendix. I don't think I've ever published it. I think some of the basics are in my notes on, back in the old C, the Center for Enochian Studies days, but they're only preliminary notes. And I only have so much time in this world to,
right,
to write articles for people. And so I have a new one coming out in the next Kofnia journal about the Unicrystal Hexagram. So.
Okay, well, so you have all of your tables set up, and then how do you go about, you figure out what signs are above the equator or the horizon?
Yes.
You know, just using just a normal astrological program.
You've got to plot this out in advance.
Right.
Even if you're doing planetary magic, you have to plot these things out in advance. The real key to doing any of these things is finding sort of the ideal times for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to call an ether down, I look at the where the governors are, and hopefully the governors are all in one table, but they're not always, but generally speaking, they're all in one table. So I figure out when the three governors are going to be above the horizon, and so I look forward to that time, and I set that time aside if I can, and I figure I'm going to do it, you know, next week or, you know, usually a week before I start planning. And then I look at the table, I look at the watchtower, and I say, okay, where are the 21 letters that constitute the three governors? Where are they located on the table? And I mark those out, and then I see what degree of hierarchy of the watchtower I need to call down to account for all of those 21 squares.
So basically you're calling like all of the superiors and working your way down to them.
Well, I think there actually seems, yeah, I'm starting with the king.
Mm-hmm.
I start with the king. I actually call up the seniors, then the king, then the seniors again. There's a reason for that having to do with the way the Enochian system is devised. The seniors show up first, and the kings show up second, and then the seniors show up again. I almost always call up all 24 seniors and all four kings in order to not be imbalanced. Elemental imbalance is one of the great problems that Enochian magicians tend to have. I've had it myself, not thinking about it. I mean, I remember one of the first things I did was call up Earth of Earth subquadrant on the Earth table and trying to get this house. Well, we got the house in about 2 weeks. The neighbors left and we had the house. But we got evicted in about a month and a half, and within 3 months that was a dirt lot, which was a lot of Earth, more Earth than I wanted. You know, and I got what I wanted, and I looked at it later and said, wow, that's really earthy. I completely understand that. But I try not to have those kind of results anymore. So I try to balance things out. I start with the 12 banners of the names, from the 12, which are drawn from the line, the center lines, which are the lines of the Holy Spirit, and the middle lines, one Oro Ibahe, OSP, etc. Then I call up the 24 seniors. Then I call up the four kings. Then I call up the seniors again. I only call up the seniors from the table I want to work from. And then I call up the king of that one table I want to work from. And then I move my way down. Yeah, depending on how much territory I have to cover, I start moving my way down through the tables, through the cross angles, through the angels above the cross, down into the subquadrants if I have to, until I've accounted for every single square of those 21 squares. And there's an order you have to go through in order to get there, that order I just gave you, which I think is explained in my thing about the Golden Talisman, which I give the names in some order.
Mm-hmm.
That name system is just derived from the Golden Talisman. I don't think there's, and from what's given in a true and faithful relation.
Now, is there any preliminary rituals that you go through? I assume just, you know, normal banishings.
I do. I banish by pentagram and hexagram. I use lesser forms of both of those things. One of the things people don't realize is both the lesser pentagram and lesser hexagram ritual are devised so that the magician can do Enochian when they get to the level of adepthood. And so they're designed around all kinds of basic kinds of Enochian assumptions. And like directions, for instance, the reason we have air in the east and water in the west and earth in the north and fire in the south is because that's the way the Enochian table, the last one that was given, what's called the Reform Table of Raphael, that's the way those elements are laid out in that table. Likewise, the reason the pentagram is attributed the way it is, the reason that the upper left-hand corner of the pentagram is attributed to air is because the upper left-hand corner of the Great Watchtower is attributed to air. The upper right-hand corner of the Great Watchtower is attributed to water, and so the upper right-hand corner of the pentagram is attributed to water, etc. And those associations that the Golden Dawn uses there are based on Enochian assumptions. Similarly, with the lesser hexagram forms, there are four forms of the lesser hexagram. There are six ways of drawing that, since there are six points, six ways of drawing and invoking, six ways of drawing and banishing. So 6 times 4 is 24. There are 24 seniors, so each one of the seniors has its own peculiar hexagram. So yeah, I have a system of working out the keys, which if you read my dissertation on the elemental attributions of the keys, can be figured out pretty well. And I use pentagrams to conjure those spirits according to their elemental attributions.
So you use the invoking pentagram of that of that element. Okay.
Right, or sub element. If you have sub elements, then you have to mix them up.
Mm-hmm.
And if something is fire of air, for instance, I use 5 pentagrams there, and I assume that the ruling table is air, which is this fire of air. So I do 3 pentagrams of air and 2 of fire. So I go air, fire, air, fire, air. And those are the princes that rule above the sub-quadrants are 5-lettered names. I vibrate the name 1 time for every pentagram I do.
Okay. And what kind of information would you be looking for from a governor?
Well, I'm trying to get the governor to sort of explain to me his part of the ether. And that varies a lot. The ethers are a wide range of territory. I start with some basic kinds of questions about how they relate to the 12 tribes, what role they, how do they rule over the territory they're assigned to, for instance. That's another one. They have geographical territory that they're assigned to. And then what part of the ether do they rule over, and what do they have to explain to me in that part of the ether? And so I in an ether vision, you're being, to a great degree, passive. And you're trying to sort of get information, sort of have them explain to you, to show you what's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to have them show me what's going on. I try to work in pairs. It's kind of difficult to both conjure and scry. I can do either one or the other. But both are difficult. It's hard to come by good conjurers. It's hard to come by good scryers. It's easier for me a little bit to come by good scryers because I can rarely get conjurers to actually do exactly what I want them to do. It's as strange as that is.
Not too strange. But so you end up being the conjurer most of the time, and you end up having a scryer.
I have good conjurers right now. I'm blessed in this regard. But this is an exception and not the norm. So recently I've been able to scry, but usually it's the other way around, yeah.
And so you're systematically going through all of them?
No, it's actually not what we've been working. We've been trying to ascertain the kings of the tables. I have not been working with ethers extensively for a while. We went through the 4 kings, then we went through, we're systematically working through the 4 horsemen that rule over them, and the 24 seniors, partially because we can attribute those to a fixed points in the year, like the other day, the water horseman, the fourth horseman came across because it was summer solstice, and summer solstice is the traditionally attributed, we just passed the other one. We did the horseman attributed to air, the swordsman, because the summer solstice came by, because the division between Gemini and Cancer passed.
Mm-hmm. So you're working with Enochian is very kind of different than Goetic workings, where generally the Goetic enterprise is to actually kind of get something from the Goetic entity.
Well, if you're actually working straight, and when I pass the lesser quadrants, I try to ask them to do stuff too, or I try to talk to them too. I don't ignore the sub quadrant angles just because I have to pass them in order to get to the governor.
Mm-hmm.
So we do try to spend some time with them, and we do try to get some stuff out of them. The king's actually in the watchtowers, actually will do stuff for you. What's it called? Keith's favorite thing: discernment and judgment and judgment in human affairs. There's two different things. One's positive, and one's negative. At the top of my head, I can't remember what it is. But so you can get them to sort of resolve sort of human social kinds of issues, political issues you might have, etc. And they will resolve them, but they have sort of larger agendas going on. The lesser angles, I do sometimes ask them to solve sort of trivial problems. Depends on where they are. If you look at Jeffrey James, you'll see that there's a sort of user's guide to the subquadrants. Some of them give you metals, money, transmutation, transportation.
Do they ever ask for anything in return?
No, they don't usually ask for things in return.
So it's a very different kind of
It's not a quid pro quo kind of arrangement, no. Yes, and Goetic, particularly the ones in not the Theurgia, but the regular Goetia that people usually work. They're very quid pro quo.
Yeah.
About it, and yes, they're arranging sort of a capitalist arrangement you have with them, and they want something, and they give you something in return for it. Not all aspects of the Goetia are like that, but even the Theurgia Goetia, they want a certain kind of, they like incense, and there's certain kinds of things they like in order to sort of the medium in which they want to work, and they want certain kinds of results from that too. It varies.
All right. Well, so then you go through and you ask them the questions, and then once you've determined that you're done, how do you go through a closing and banishing? And
you banish all the damn things you had to invoke in the first place. I usually banish a lot faster than I invoke. So banish through everything, and then I don't use the keys again. I only use the keys to get in, and I banish back out. And once I'm done with all the watchtower machinery I have to banish, then I banish the hexagram and banish the pentagram and purify and consecrate again. I purify and consecrate before I start anything. Purify and consecrate again and go take a bath.
And so this whole enterprise sounds like it takes quite a few hours.
It can be long, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think how long it took us the other day. We started about 11:30, we were done, I think, about 2:45.
So about 3 hours there.
3 hours, yeah.
And how much...
The mechanics of, you know, when people are first conjuring, particularly in any given system, it takes longer because you're systematically trying to figure out what you're doing as you're going along, even if you have it written down. But after a while, it becomes sort of second nature.
And so you actually can go quickly one to the other.
Yeah, I think it probably took us 40 minutes to get in last time. I'd have to look, about 20 minutes to get out. So of all that time, about an hour of it was taken in conjuring.
Now, when you say you'd have to go look, so you're obviously taking notes during this whole process?
Somebody is. Hopefully you got somebody who's keeping track of what's going on, yeah.
So you generally work with three people?
We've been working with three to four people, yeah.
Okay. And so somebody's
tried taping it, and actually they're getting pretty good at taping. I have to admit, I used to be a complete I was averse to taping, but I had a lot of failures with taping, and it didn't seem to work very well. I don't tape, but they do, and so.
And then they transcribe later?
Then they transcribe, yeah.
And are they using conventional like taping, or are they now working with like MP3 players? And
no, they got one of those like your little hand with a tiny cassette player.
Okay, and that seems to work.
Seems to work every once I hear the clicking in the background when they're switching out the tapes. Yeah.
All right. Seems
to work, but the person who's taking the way we have it worked out. The person who's taking care of the tape is also trying to write stuff down, and all they're really doing is monitoring the tape.
Mm-hmm.
And they take notes as we go along. And sometimes it, you know, comes in, phases in and out. You don't want the recording device to be particularly intrusive.
Right.
So.
Okay. Well, if somebody wanted to really start getting into this, you mentioned a True and Faithful Relation. What other books would you recommend that they start reading?
Well, they should start with, Enochian is one of those things, and unfortunately, you need to, at some point along the way, read pretty much everything that's out there. Although, unfortunately, now when I started doing it, everything that was out there wasn't very much. Now, everything that's out there is an awful lot, particularly if you count the crap that's on the internet, and most of which it is. It's mostly just horrific and awful in every possible way. And I try to talk to these people and figure out why they do what they do and what they get out of what they get, and I don't seem to. They don't seem to make a lot of sense to me, but hey, if it gets them off, that's fine. I think Jeffrey James, is Jeffrey James back in print? I think it is. I think you can get it from Llewellyn. There's a really nice little book called Elizabethan Magic by a man named Robert Turner, which covers a lot of the same material. Those are both good places to begin. Peterson's John Dee's Five Books of Mystery is something you probably should plow through. If you get that in a True and Faithful, you have all the essential visions, pretty much. Anything you're going to need for the next, 4 or 5 years, anyway. There's more detailed stuff you'll need at some point. People should read the Monads, should read the Hieroglyphic Monad to understand what Dee's underlying logic is. And I think a good biography of Dee is worthwhile. Charlotte Fell Smith's out there. John French, I think his name is, has another one. And I think there's the Calder thesis is out there. Cluley's book on Dee is useful as places to start, sort of in the middle. I like Tyson, although I don't agree with everything he says. Tyson asks the tough questions. I don't like the way he resolves everything, but at least he's attempting to resolve it. His book on Enochian is good. His book called Tetragrammaton is okay, and his Agrippa is invaluable. It's probably the best edition of the three books of Agrippa that's ever been done. You need Agrippa because Agrippa is the foundation from which Dee is working. All the basic principles underlying Western ceremonial magic are set forth in books 2 and 3 of Agrippa. So I think they're invaluable. I mean, even things like 777, which Thelemic magicians take sort of for granted are based on the scales that are set down in Agrippa's three books mm-hmm. called Philosophy.
Now, you mentioned earlier Dee wrote an introduction about Euclidean geometry.
He did. He wrote an introduction to Euclid, and I'm a big fan of Euclid, too. I don't know, good magic and geometry are closely interrelated, and I don't think it's a whole lot to ask people to get a decent copy of, Dover edition of Euclid and get a straight edge and a compass and try to resolve how to construct those figures, because a lot of what happens in Enochian magic is based on geometric principles. Without that geometry, you're kind of lost.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the introduction to Euclid, I don't know, I have a copy that I don't know where you can get that still. You can get it from a library, I'm sure. It's been reprinted sometime in the late 80s it was reprinted. It's pretty easy to come by as far as interlibrary learning goes. It's not very long. It's about 20 pages long. It's an interesting document. And a lot of the principles underlying Enochian are made clearer if you read that introduction to Euclid. but I don't think it's the most, it's not the most critical thing that somebody has to start with. He wrote another book called the Propaedeutica Aphoristica, which is commonly published as De on Astronomy. And I know it's not in print, but it's, again, pretty easy to come by in university libraries. And it's really useful when you get to the Sigillum because it really does explain a lot of the astrological and astronomical principles upon which the system of the Sigillum works. But that's a different system. It's not watchtowers. If you're just doing watchtowers to begin with, you know, get a Euclid.
Okay.
The Dover beginning, also, there's a lot of really interesting, particularly in the first volume of the Dover, three volumes of Euclid, there's a lot of really interesting information about Dee because Dee's introduction to Euclid was the standard introduction to Euclid up through the middle of the 18th century for a good 300 years. The Billingsley's edition, and so you can find those around. I've known people who had them, and so that's useful from that point of view, if nothing else, and explains a lot of what we have of Euclid survived because Dee kept it. So he was actually physically involved in the survival of the text of Euclid that we have now.
Well, fantastic. It's obviously a lot of work to get involved in this and actually do it right. But
I don't know, doing it right. Do any of us, that's what I ask myself. You know, do any of us do it right all the time? It's a science, and so you're approaching it from approaching it as an experimental endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I try to do in my writings is I try to maybe transfer it a little bit from being a science to being a technology. Something that people can apply with some consistent results, but I only know that I partially succeed at that,
mm-hmm.
and that's just what it is. You know, we all have to wander out into the unknown a little bit sometimes. One of the advantages to Enochian is that there are still large swaths of it that are, you know, fairly unknown, you know, fairly unworked. So there's a lot of, you know, information that can be gleaned out there if you really work at it. And if, you know, if there are parts of your own magical practice that you don't understand, one of the ways of approaching it, that's what Enochian's for, is say, okay, you know, I don't understand how the lesser hexagram works, or I don't understand why pentagrams are the way that they are, or some of the angels give you secrets of men, you know, I don't understand this degree I just took in whatever, you know, silly occult orders that we belong to. Please explain this to me. And it's amazing how lucid their explanations can be at times, and how useful they can be at providing you with information about things that you didn't understand before.
If somebody wanted to get in touch with you, how should they do so?
I'm in MySpace. People should find me in MySpace. I think MySpace is a great networking resource. I don't blog a lot there. I don't put a lot of stuff up there. But as far as actually just getting in contact with people who are interested and people I know, you know, send me an email through MySpace, which is...
I'll put it in the show notes.
Thank you very much. It's Caronton Club at some level, and I'm listed under my real name, David R. Jones.
Okay. Well, this is... it's already been about an hour, so I'm sure we could keep going on this, but...
No, it's okay. We're okay. I'm flies when you're having fun.
Sounds great. So I really appreciate you being on the show and talking a lot about
this.
An
honor, in fact. To be in the rogues gallery of your show.
Well, there's been a large variety of people on it, so.
So I hear. I have many friends. I'm not a big fan of podcasts, and I can't honestly say I've listened to any of them ever. And but my friends all think your podcast is the best.
Well, thank you.
Including my local friends in this environment, they're like, wow, it's a great podcast. So you have great reviews from the larger. Polemic community.
Well, that is very flattering, and thank you for saying so.
The only people who don't like your podcast are the people who never listen to it.
No, that's not true.
Well, at least the people I've talked to who say they don't like your podcast, I've asked them, and none of them have listened to it.
No, well, that's true, and usually they do that because they don't like my politics or something, which is, I guess, judging a book by its cover, but... What can you do?
As Thelemites, you know, there's an exercise in Libra 3 about politics, and this exercise applies to politics, both on the national, local, and whatever social organizations you belong to. But the idea is, you know, if you get a ring and you put it on one finger,
mm-hmm.
and you adopt the point of view that you would normally have, maybe, or some arbitrary point of view, and you move it over to the other hand, and you adopt some other political point of view, and after a while you realize that those political points of view are somewhat arbitrary. And even if you don't agree with somebody else's politics, you need to respect them sometimes. And you know, dissent is a great thing. It's a blessing and virtue of the Enlightenment that, you know, we're supposed to have learned from our forefathers and, you know, our Masonic forebears or whoever, you know, came up with the Constitution of the United States, the Illuminati, or whoever people want to blame for that. This idea of dissent and free speech is a great thing, and people shouldn't be offended by it. But we live in a culture now where it's acceptable to be down on free speech on a lot of levels. We really say that's what we're down on, but in fact that's what it is.
But David, you're either with me or you're against me, and that's just all it comes down to.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you said that. Very good sarcasm. you know, the thing is, if that were the case, I wouldn't be associated with anybody, because nobody, as far as I know, is with me all the time, and very few people are against everything I stand for. So, I mean, who would I associate with? In fact, I try, when I find that people agree with me too much, I try to find a few things we disagree with, so we can... It's annoying to me when people agree with me too much.
You have nothing to talk about.
I mean, well, I know, I'm sure I'm wrong. I don't know. If people agree with me too much, there's something wrong with what I'm saying.
That's true. All right, well, thanks again for being on the podcast.
Okay, well, I look forward to listening to myself and my tinny voice.
It hasn't been bad at all.
Okay.
93.
Love is the law.
Well, that about does it for podcast 42. So thanks to William and Keith and David for being on the show. And also thanks to you for listening. The time is getting short before my move. So there's probably only going to be about one or two more podcasts before I go. And there probably will be a delay in August and September before I kind of get back into the swing of things and can start releasing material in whatever format that's going to be. So I would ask those who have the Thelema Coast to Coast podcast RSS feed to not unsubscribe. I will... You know, when the podcast has its next incarnation, once I'm in settled in Europe, I will be using that same feed to release material. So, you know, hang in there. But in the meantime, I'll probably be doing one or two more podcasts before I go. Lastly, our outgoing music. This is a very different tune. This is an older one from the mid-70s. It's from a group called Aphrodite's Child. It is a concept album that they put out based on the Book of Revelation, and the album was called 666, and this song is The Four Horsemen, and I figured this was appropriate based on the conversation that I had with David Jones, and in particular, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse and their relationship to the Enochian Tables. Thanks again for listening to the podcast, and here's The Four Horsemen by Aphrodite's Child. Love is the law. Love under will.